I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of what happens to one woman when her same-sex marriage comes to an end. Cassandra Ormiston had spent 40 years hoping for the right to get married in the first place, and she was among those who leapt at the chance back when the law was changed in Massachusetts. So it was that much harder on her when she realized the marriage she had fought for was over.
There came a knock at my door, and it was a constable who asked me to sign a piece of paper and handed me Bobby's petition for divorce. The final domino kind of fell, and we were not able to communicate at all.
It turns out, to her dismay, that the fight to end the marriage has become as legally complicated as the fight to get married was in the first place. The legal system in her state doesn't appear ready to offer an end to a marriage that it doesn't recognize. I'll talk with Cassandra Ormiston about getting into and out of a same-sex marriage right after the news. Cassandra Ormiston struggled with her sexuality when she was a teenager, back in the early 60s. It was a difficult time for anyone to declare that they were gay or lesbian.
Oh, my mother was distraught. And she, as most mothers back then, understood enough about current thought to know it was her fault.
But Cassandra was not swayed by social pressure. She knew she was a lesbian. And years later, when she was in her late 40s, she considered herself extremely lucky to meet Bobby, the woman she would eventually marry.
Bobby had called and said she wanted to speak with me. And so we met at Sambuca and over our lattes or whatever. We talked in terms of, I think I'm falling in love with you. And it was from that moment that things truly did change and began a decade of what I can only call real happiness.
Cassandra and Bobby considered themselves even more fortunate to live in a time when they could be legally married. And they were. But like many marriages, theirs did not last. And now they find themselves in search of something that the state tells them they cannot have. And that is a legal same-sex divorce. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Just a few weeks back, the Supreme Court in California swept aside the last legal barrier to same-sex marriage in that state, making it the second state after Massachusetts to allow gay and lesbian partners to get legally married. It's still the sort of headline that raises eyebrows on cable TV.
So California, shockingly, is now the second state where gay and lesbian residents can marry. Now, the court
and,
said...
it's just an extraordinary day because California Supreme Court, 6 out of 7 judges of which were Republican
in very plain English, it is a basic civil right to marry someone that you love, which includes all Californians, whether they're gay or heterosexual. And so as long as that ruling is, that's what it boils down to.
Cassandra Ormiston remembers the day she married her partner, Bobby. Back in the spring of 2004, the two of them were living in Rhode Island, just a short drive from the towns and cities in Massachusetts where people could finally find a judge to marry them.
When we arrived in Fall River and we applied for the marriage license, we were told that there was a 3-day waiting period. Would we be interested in seeking a waiver so that we could get this done right away? And we said, yes, of course. And so a young woman hurriedly walked us to a courtroom. And there we found a judge who, I don't recall the reason, was not able to hear our waiver plea. Then a second judge, she hurries us off to the next courtroom, a second judge, and he too was unavailable. The third judge, I don't even know his name, an older man, shock of white hair, bright blue eyes, sitting behind the bench. He looks down at us and looks at our petition for this waiver and says, Cassandra, do you know what you're doing? And I said, yes, Judge, I do. And he asked the same question of Bobby. And she said, yes, I do. And he signed the waiver. And we dashed back. And then we were married. And then we were married. My feet hardly touched the ground for 3 days at least. It was just a miracle.
When you think back and examine that sense of euphoria that you're describing, was it being married, was it having that right that meant so much, or was it being married to Bobby, being one half of that partnership?
Ah. Well, surely at the bottom of it all is that I was able to marry the woman I loved legally and to have our community acknowledge and affirm our love for one another. Being able to marry at the age of 58, having started out in 1965, I was elated with this new freedom. During all of our previous years, we had done everything we could to make our relationship look as much like marriage as we could. Our wills, our power of attorney, the property we owned, everything was owned equally and together. I suspect that anyone who is granted a new freedom where it has been denied, for that person, it's a more profound experience.
Cassandra Ormiston says, at the time when she was married, she and Bobby knew that their wedding certificate wasn't quite the same back home in Rhode Island.
We didn't have all of the rights and privileges that come with marriage because we still had to file our income tax separately. We still didn't have access to health care that was affordable on a family basis. I mean, there were things that still we lacked, but the acknowledgement by society of our love for one another was profound and moving to me.
Although by the simple act of crossing the state line from Massachusetts back into Rhode Island, some of the legality, some of the recognition was taken away from you, wasn't it?
Yes, but that isn't the part we'd focused on.
No, we're in honeymoon period now.
We certainly were. And a couple of weeks after we married, we had a wonderful party.
At your place?
Yes. And a dear friend did the catering, and we invited all of our friends. And it was early June, and the grandchildren read poetry. And Adrian, grandson, handed me the ring I put on Bobby's finger. Avery handed Bobby the ring she put on mine. And a good friend read the vows again. Certainly it was moving and wonderful for us, but it made a difference to people. And they were happy, truly happy for us.
Do you remember the moment when most of the guests had left and you and Bobby got to sort of sit in your favorite chair and put your feet up and go, wow, what was that? Do you remember that?
Well, actually, like youngsters, we didn't wait for all the guests to leave. We drove off and went to Ogunquit, Maine, and we went away for a few days.
You left the party in full swing to start your honeymoon.
We did. No cans attached to our bumper, but metaphorically, I know that they were. That first night we went out to dinner and our young waiter, and this is a very gay-friendly town, our young waiter welcomed us and how did you choose Ogunquit? And we said, well, we've been here before, but we are here on our honeymoon. And the owner brought us out two beautiful flutes and a bottle of champagne.
Yeah, I was going to say these are fairy tale scenes.
I know. This is really how it was.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. After the honeymoon came life as a married couple, and for both Bobby and Cassandra that meant new challenges. In their case, it was health issues. Bobby was nearing the age of 70. Cassandra was 60. The threat of breast cancer led Cassandra to have a double mastectomy, while Bobby had trouble with her knees. But the way that Cassandra recalls it, it was mainly that they started taking their relationship for granted.
We stopped communicating in that wonderful way we had all those years.
You're not saying you stopped talking. You're saying you stopped communicating.
Oh, no.
It's something different,
yeah.
Right?
Very different. Yes. We were always civil and correct, and all of our friends all were just shocked because we appeared to be the golden couple. And in some ways, we still were. But we didn't have the fullness of the connection we had had before. And so when people say, well, what happened? How is it that your marriage failed? I just have to think that, like so many other couples, we just forgot how important the work couples have to do every single day in relationship. And even before Bobby's surgery, the issue even of immobility puts a strain on a relationship.
Yeah. Though I can see this having the opposite effect, drawing you closer together as you needed each other for that kind of comfort and recuperation. I'm not trying to rewrite history here, but I mean, it goes two different ways, right?
No, you and I take your point, but that closeness, that bond, never brought us back to that point in the first decade, the point we had reached where when we talked with each other, we really heard each other. We really listened with our hearts, not just with our minds. And so, again, it was the kind of mundane failure of not paying attention.
Cassandra and Bobby decided that the home they owned was too large, and the stairs were bothering Bobby's knees, so they moved into a condo. But they quickly realized they had downsized too far.
Our home before was a four-square, four bedrooms,
yeah,
each corner of the second floor. And so we had our bedroom, we had a dressing room, and we each had our own private study. There was nothing like that in this house.
So now you were sort of in each other's business at times when you didn't want to be, right?
In each other's way, almost. So we started talking about continuing, still being married, but having separate residences. And we, actually, one of our good friends goes forward in his marriage with just such an arrangement. So we knew couples who lived apart, but were still married, and it strengthened their relationship. And so we were working on that model.
And this decision to live apart, this wasn't in any way an acknowledgement on your part or on Bobby's part that something profound had changed in your relationship?
No, we had not had the conversations we would come to have. We just saw the positive side of how this new arrangement would benefit our relationship and our marriage.
So when did the prospect of divorce then appear?
We did not ever talk about divorce. We talked about this new arrangement would help. But after about a month, the final domino kind of fell and we were not able to communicate at all.
What happened?
I wish I could tell you. I don't know of any single event.
But how did you know something had changed? Did Bobby stop talking to you? Did she not answer your calls?
Yes.
What happened?
There came a knock at my door and it was a constable who asked me to sign a piece of paper and handed me Bobby's petition for divorce.
And that was
the first I knew of divorce.
Cassandra Ormiston had a second shock coming. Once she got used to the idea that her marriage was over, both she and Bobby would then discover that, at least for them, the right to a same-sex marriage did not come with the right to a same-sex divorce. I'll talk more with Cassandra in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Back in 2004, and again this spring, the headlines were full of stories about legal same-sex marriages, first in Massachusetts, now in California. However, that marriage certificate, many couples have since discovered, does not bring with it all the same rights that marriages historically confer in the sharing of assets and the planning for retirement and inheritance. In the case of Cassandra Ormiston and Bobby, it seems it hasn't even given them the right to end their marriage. It is, for Cassandra, one more challenge that began for her back in the late 50s in Cleveland, Ohio. She was coming to terms then with the fact that she was a lesbian. Her dad worked for GM, her mother was at home, and to her parents, success was rooted in conformity.
I had my first girlfriend, and it was one of those innocent high school infatuations, but it was clear to everyone in the school on the west side of Cleveland, a very conservative part of the Midwest, that we were infatuated with one another. And we went from being well thought of and liked to being alienated.
How did you work it out with your parents, with your family?
I was saved the necessity of having to break the news because my first girlfriend did. She was so guilt-ridden, she confessed to my mother. I think I thought that was humorous even at the time.
What was your mother's reaction? What happened when your girlfriend blew the whistle?
Oh, my mother was distraught. And she, as most mothers back then, understood enough about current thought to know it was her fault. There was something she had done that made me something other than normal. And my mother and I struggled together. Dick, it must have taken 15 years for my mother to come out. I spoke with her yesterday. She said to me, I didn't understand until I came out as the mother of a lesbian how powerful it is to do so.
Was there a time back in the early 60s when you thought that your sexual orientation was something that could be changed or should be cured? Or was there a time early on when you thought, oh, maybe I am, you know, ill or not normal?
Well, I don't think I ever thought of it in those terms, but I did see that it was inconvenient. And I believed for a very short while that I would be happier if I identified myself as a heterosexual. I think it lasted 6 months. I was about 21, 22, dated a very nice young man, but it was clear within a very short period of time that this is not a choice for me. I can't speak for anyone else, but this is just my essential self.
Can you think of one of those moments that was particularly difficult for you back then?
This may not seem harsh, but it felt it at the time. I was in the library doing some research for some paper and was flipping through a current publication, and there was a picture of two women, heads together, not gay women, just heads together. And underneath that picture, someone had scrawled our names, and then I don't remember what words they wrote. I just remember how much that hurt in the moment.
Cassandra Ormiston had a number of relationships as she got older, but she distinctly remembers meeting Bobby, the woman she was to marry. When they met, Bobby was the caregiver for an elderly woman named Freedom, a woman with 1,000 stories and wonderful taste in good living.
At the time, she was 89 years old. Shortly after I met Frida, and we did like each other right away, it was then that I began to go every day and sit by her bedside.
Tell me how the love affair between you and Bobby began.
Well, Bobby was Frida's primary caretaker. I mean, she did such a wonderful job taking care of Frida. I came on the scene, and it provided Bobby with some respite. So I became, in a small way, involved in Frida's daily routine. And it was in those last months of her life that Bobby and I became aware that our affection for each other was growing. And then after Frida died, we began to talk about the fact that we were caring for each other in a different way.
You'd had other partners before Cassandra. I'm sure Bobby had as well. What was it between the two of you? How do you look back? And what would be the words that you would use to describe the relationship? Or maybe even an event, a moment when you knew that you guys were right for each other.
Well, even before falling in love with her, I was certainly taken by her. She's smart, and she's an excellent conversationalist. We share the same positions on public matters. Our minds work in kind of the same way. And we're both older. We were not kids when we met, and less so now. Then there's the chemistry thing. I don't know exactly how that works, but there has to be that, I don't know, that rule of attraction, and it was there.
Was there a time that you recall when you were both able to sort of look at each other and say, yes, you are the one?
Yes, I remember exactly. We met for a cup of coffee, and Bobby had called and said she wanted to speak with me. And so we met at Sambusco and over our lattes or whatever. Acknowledged that our feelings were different. We talked in terms of, I think I'm falling in love with you. And it was from that moment that things truly did change and began a decade of what I can only call real happiness.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Bobby and Cassandra went on to get married. They were among the people who went to Massachusetts back in 2004 to take advantage of the change in the law in that state. But the marriage and the relationship did not last. Cassandra was telling me earlier about the day when she was living alone, and she went to the front door where she was handed the petition for divorce.
When I walked inside and unfolded the piece of paper and her petition citing irreconcilable differences was there for me to read.
What were you thinking?
I don't know. I don't know what I did next. But within a short period of time, it was pretty much all I could do was kind of cry and shake my fist at the sky, you know? What has happened here? Let's just sit down and talk. We can work this out. And if divorce is the way we choose to go, certainly we can do this. We can do this the right way. And I've been asked this question, Dick, time after time. What happened? And it's not that I've not thought about it. I do not know what happened that has brought us to this place of complete estrangement. But like the majority of marriages that take place in this country, ours did fail.
Cassandra Ormiston says it was hard enough coming to terms with the end of their relationship, but then both she and Bobby discovered how hard it was going to be to end the marriage legally in Rhode Island, in the state they called home.
The divorce petition was filed in family court, and immediately, and Bobby being the plaintiff, me the defendant, and immediately the chief justice of this family court sent to the superior court the question of whether or not family court could hear this divorce petition between two same-sex people. One of the questions asked in that motion was, did these two people marry only for the purpose of divorcing in order to further a gay agenda? I was offended then. I will be offended until I die.
I want to be clear, I understand this, the idea of, yes, of forwarding a gay agenda. This is establishing the right to divorce or establishing...
We were the pawns of the gay activist lobby, whoever that is. Our activism, Bobby's and mine and ours individually, we vote, we pay our taxes, yeah, we're good neighbors. We believe ourselves to be good citizens. That's how political we are, but we have never been activists in the cause of gay rights.
Okay, but let me go back, if I can, to the spring of 2004,
sure,
when you got married. You got married, sure, in the state of Massachusetts. That state sanctioned your marriage. Correct. Rhode Island never did. Was that not also a part of the mm-hmm legal puzzle here, that how mm-hmm could we annul mm-hmm a wedding or a marriage that we hadn't recognized in the first place?
Well, the statutes in Rhode Island are gender neutral.
Oh.
They neither allow or disallow marriage between same-sex individuals. So Bobby's lawyer filed in family court. But since 1961, no divorce in Rhode Island has been granted to anyone except in family court. And so when the Supreme Court handed down their decision that family court could not hear this divorce because they did not have jurisdiction, it's just wrong.
And this is 6 months ago, right, when the Supreme Court did
correct
this?
Correct. Correct.
And so what's happened since then?
Well, just in the last 2 weeks, Bobby's lawyer filed a motion in Superior Court asking the Superior Court to ask the Supreme Court the same question that family court asked the Supreme Court, that is, does Superior Court have jurisdiction to hear this divorce?
Cassandra Ormiston sees her own situation as something of a warning to others, that even as states like California are allowing same-sex marriages, people like Cassandra and Bobby are stuck trying to end one of those marriages.
I don't know what the nuances are, but I do know that after nearly 2 years, I can no longer pursue this fight for my civil rights.
Why?
Well, because I can't fund it any longer.
Well, you have to pay all the way through.
Absolutely. There have been opponents of our right to divorce who have said publicly, well, you know, they're funded by who knows? Who knows who they think is sending us checks that we then turn around and send to our attorneys? No one is.
How much is this costing you, Cassandra?
I don't know the exact number yet.
Thousands?
And so
tens of
I
thousands?
Step back. Well, a couple, huh? Without a settlement, Dick, and because there's no forum for divorce, there's no forum for settlement. There's no way to press that matter. We have not divided our assets. My savings are depleted. I wouldn't be surprised if Bobby could make the same statement. I have very good friends in Cambridge who have agreed to rent me a room for as long as I need, thereby establishing residency in Massachusetts. And once that is done, this clock starts ticking toward the one-year residency requirement.
Hang on, let me make sure I understand this, Cassandra. Sure. If you change your residency to that of Massachusetts, if you are a recognized citizen of that state, does that make pursuing the divorce a whole lot easier because you were married in Massachusetts?
It makes it absolutely doable.
Why beat your head against the superior courts of Rhode Island if you could have done this a while ago?
Well, I did not believe 2 years ago when all of this started that I would be denied the right to divorce. Mm-hmm. I never thought, knowing Providence as I did, knowing that its founders, 1638, these people came from puritanical Massachusetts to found a state where freedom and liberty sacrosanct. So I expected more of Rhode Island.
If you could wind the clock back, all the way back mm-hmm. to the spring of 04, mm-hmm. would you still have got married?
Absolutely.
No hesitation?
None. I am a proponent of marriage.
Well, no, I get that, but you, it sounds
value.
Like you've got half a right. You know, you have the right to get into this and not the right to get out of it.
Well, and there's the rub, huh? And you know what, Dick? People try and inflame this issue by calling it a gay rights matter. This is not a gay rights matter. This is about my minority's civil rights, our equal rights, our human rights. And as long as any one of us doesn't have those rights, everyone's rights are in jeopardy. And if I was a wealthy woman, I would press the matter in Rhode Island. But I'm not.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Cassandra Ormiston says it's one thing to focus on the legal struggle, the right to get that divorce. It's something else entirely to cope with the loss of friends and family and even grandchildren.
Yes. Boy, do I miss those grandchildren.
You don't see Adrian or Avery anymore?
I see Adrian occasionally. Adrian has kept my heart in his pocket since he was an infant. They are wonderful people, these kids. And I miss them.
I wonder, Cassandra, if you'd just ever shake your head at the fact that whatever irreconcilable difficulties separated you, you remain joined by this kind of public crusade to say, you know what? We have the right to be separate. You're almost together in saying you have the right to be separate. It's bizarre in a way.
Indeed. That's the dichotomy I was speaking about before, to be together on one page and then not on the other, the personal part. Are we bound together in this political struggle? I don't know that, because Bobby has chosen, as is her right, not to be a public voice in this matter. I completely respect that. But for me, Dick, I will tell you that I will be bound to Bobby for the rest of my life. For me, Bobby will be a part of my life forever because I will always love Bobby. I didn't fall in love with her frivolously. I did not marry her without consideration. And I've not come to a place where I can just turn off the feelings that led to that commitment. And I don't really seek to do that. Well, she's made me angry, some of the things that have happened, and I'm sure I have made her angry as well. But I will have a place in my heart for her forever.
Ever a time, Cassandra, when you think of just setting aside the public part, not fighting for divorce, just saying, you know what, the relationship is at an end. I'm getting on with my life.
I thought about it a lot before I decided to allow my voice to be a public one. But the fact is, there are times in our lives when we will be challenged. At this particular time in my life, I am able. I am older. I'm 61 years old. No one is going to hurt my career. No one, because I'm out absolutely, can hurt my relationships with the people I care about. No one can say you can't go to church there because you're a lesbian. Mm. I'm at this point in my life, and isn't it, I find, here's the great gift of getting older. As we get older, we are freer to truly speak our minds, and we've had time to figure out what we really believe. And that's where I find myself. And so even if I don't pursue this matter in the courts of Rhode Island, and even though I wasn't an activist before this began, I intend to continue to speak. Millions of us have come out and acknowledged, have told people who we are. Millions of us. And when you're no longer invisible, when you're no longer silent, people don't turn their back on you.
Cassandra Ormiston joined me from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. If you have thoughts or reactions to Cassandra's story, or maybe you have your own and perhaps untold story of the way that you see marriage and relationships changing around us, get in touch with me. Go to our website at thestory.org, where you can leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The editor of a literary magazine based here in Chapel Hill recently faced an awful dilemma for someone in his business. Cy Safransky is the editor and publisher of The Sun. His monthly print run had just been packaged up, ready for delivery, when Cy discovered that there was a serious mistake in this issue of the magazine, in each one of the 80,000 copies of this issue of the magazine. How Cy sorted this all out and why he chose to share this mistake with his entire readership is what makes this story so interesting. You see, it concerns a short piece of writing, one that was sent in by a prisoner. The prisoner wrote about what happens when you meet a rival gang member in the exercise yard. Here's part of what the prisoner wrote. The gate opens. You and your opponent eye each other's hands, looking for weapons. Relieved to find one another unarmed, you butt heads like rams during the rutting season. Blows are traded. Guards are running towards you. The guards use pepper spray. It's all over. Aggression spent. You lie prone on the ground. A split brow, a busted nose, cuts and scrapes all over. You and your rival meet each other's eyes, both pleased with the outcome. You are deemed a stand-up convict. Cy Safransky and his editors thought it was a strong piece, so they published it.
What went wrong is that he had asked that his piece be printed as name withheld because he feared if we did print his name, there might be, and these are his words, negative flack that he would get from other prisoners. We made a mistake, and we didn't discover that mistake. We printed his name. We didn't discover that mistake until after the issue was printed. And the way we discovered it is that we had sent him a galley of the edited piece, but since he's on death row and mail travels slowly through the prison system, he didn't get it until too late. And he, well, almost too late, as it turned out. And he asked someone to call us. I still don't know who it was. I didn't take the call. Maybe it was a lawyer or a prisoner's rights representative. So we got a call on a Friday afternoon saying that he wanted us to know that this piece was to be name withheld.
He had already seen his letter in the galley of your magazine,
yes,
with his name there.
Yes.
And he's calling us and saying,
yes,
please don't do,
yes,
this.
Yes. We couldn't call him back. I don't think they, you know, bring the phone to prisoners on death row to ask him just what he meant by negative flack, just what the consequences of this would be. So we were left to imagine that for ourselves.
At the time, you weren't really too sure how far along the printing of the magazine was.
We weren't. That's right. We after we got this phone call, our managing editor, Tim McKee, called the printer and was told that, yeah, they've been printed and they're out on the loading dock. The trucks are coming to bring them to the post office. And we said, well, how about just stopping those trucks while we figure out what we're doing?
How many issues of the magazine size?
This is 80,000 copies.
And is there a simple way of explaining what the value of that investment would be to you, to the magazine?
Well, the value of it, I suppose, would be the value, the cost of reprinting it, which was about $35,000.
Oh, so as the publisher of a small magazine, you now had a $35,000 question hanging over you.
That's right.
What happened next?
What happened is that we sat down over the next few days and first tried to figure out if there would be some way to fix this without reprinting the issues. And we went through all sorts of possibilities, taking a magic marker and lining up people and everyone trying to...
Doing each magazine.
Doing each one or somehow getting rid of it, rubbing alcohol and all these different things that people had suggested.
Rubbing alcohol?
Yeah. Someone at the printer said that if you rub it with, if you rub the type with rubbing alcohol.
Like with on a Q-tip or something,
on
right?
On a Q-tip, right. It will take off the image. And so we sent somebody out to get, we didn't have any rubbing alcohol. We sent somebody out to get it and to get Q-tips and we tried it and the page fell apart, you know, before the type came off. We called printer back and the person told us, no, she didn't mean regular rubbing alcohol. This was a particular rubbing alcohol with a solvent in it that was actually quite toxic. It's used in print shops, but if we were going to use it for something like this, people would have had to wear gloves and goggles. And the thought of doing that, having people do that, was very unappealing to me.
Did you think of just taking that one page out, all the letters on that page, just cutting it out? Or?
Well, we could have done that. It would have been of enormous inconvenience to our readers. And it didn't strike me as being fair to, you know, our readership. And God knows how many phone calls we would have gotten asking what happened to my issue. So when it came time to, you know, to figure out what to do, we tried to assess just how much risk he might actually be in.
Well, I was going to ask you, the guy's on death row, right?
Right.
So he is virtually locked away from anyone else except for exercise time, as he wrote in his letter, right?
Right.
He's never going to get out.
Right.
The only risk is going to come from people in prison.
Right.
And was there a part of you thinking, we can finesse this? You know, we'll write him a nice apologetic letter saying we've made a terrible mistake. Hope this is no inconvenience. Hope there's no negative flack. Did you think about that as an option?
I certainly did think about it.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. While Cy Safransky was considering his options and the financial costs, he did a little more research that made his dilemma even more complicated. He looked into the prisoner's background.
Well, he was convicted of murder, and it was a reading about it was very difficult for me. It was a particularly brutal act, and I experienced something that was odd because I don't usually read about details of crimes. And what I felt rise up in me for a moment was, well, who cares if something happens to him? I felt such aversion to what he had done. Then I realized, though, that if I just left it there, I would be, in a way, recreating the whole penal system in this country, which, to my mind, ends up punishing people again and again for what they've done.
Still, so here you were, knowing what this fellow's crime was, knowing that it was a particularly brutal murder.
Yeah.
It did weigh in your balancing, what should we do to protect this guy's safety, right?
Yes. Yes. So, you know, on one side, you could put the brutal murder, you could put the fact that he was on death row, you could say that negative flack, who knows what that meant, maybe somebody calling him a name or pushing him. But on the other side, and this is what I suggested to our staff that we consider when we sat around talking about this, what if it were one of us in there? How concerned would we be with the risk that we were at? And as I said in that letter that I sent to our reader subsequently, it became obvious that this was one of us. To draw a distinction between him and anybody in the room would go against really everything the magazine is about, which is to respect everyone's basic humanity, irrespective of what they've done.
I see what you mean. The same principle that would lead you to put his letter in the magazine mm-hmm. is the principle that you would need to embrace in respecting his wishes, right?
Right. And, you know, there's also a question of journalistic ethics. He had asked that his name be withheld. Now, if we had gotten a phone call at the last minute from a prominent wealthy person who said, look, you know, you have to fix this mistake, I guess to my mind, there would be no difference. Really, irrespective of who it was, we would need to do that. And I didn't see any legitimacy in making an exemption for him since he was on death row. Aside from which, people sit on death row for many, many years.
That's true. Yeah.
And whatever life he had there, it certainly he was able to write the piece he wrote for The Sun. He did it out of a spirit of offering up his example to others.
Well, and his trust in you, too.
Yes. Yes.
So just to back up for half a second now, had you ruled out going through each one of those 80,000 magazines piece by piece and figuring out some way of covering it
we ruled it out in part because it would have cost a lot of money simply to hire people to do that. It would have taken an inordinate amount of time.
Right.
80,000 copies is a lot of copies. So it just seemed ungainly that it was cleaner and better to just go ahead and reprint.
Is that what you did?
Yeah, we did. We reprinted all 80,000 copies and had the printer recycle the ones that we didn't send, which created its own little side issue for us, which was, you know, the environmental cost of reprinting.
It cost Zisafransky $35,000 to reprint this issue of the magazine, a serious loss for any small magazine, but especially for The Sun, because Cy doesn't accept advertising. His magazine relies entirely on subscriptions and sales and donations. So Cy chose to tell this story in his annual fundraising letter to all The Sun's readers.
And the reason that I told this story in our annual fundraising letter, thanks to the generosity of our readers over the years who do respond, we were financially able to do it without my having to cut salaries or, you know, something of that nature. If that had been the choice, it would have been an even more difficult choice for me. I like to think I would have made that decision anyway. But the magazine is supported by its readers.
And so what did you say in the fundraising letter? What was the point that you wanted to make?
Well, I told the story not too differently from the way we're talking about it now, and I thanked our readers for their support in the past because that support has not only helped us get through various crises that any independent publication faces,
right,
but it allowed us to get through this one and do what was ethically right. And I expressed my appreciation for that, and I reminded readers that supporting the magazine is a good idea because you never know what challenge you're going to be facing.
What kind of response did you get, Cy?
We got a terrific response. And as we really do every year when we send out this letter, I did have some concern that there would be readers who would say, well, look, first they made a mistake, printed his name, and he's a convict, he's on death row, he's a murderer. I don't know if I feel so moved to sit down and write out a check. But they did, and which was gratifying. And well, we've also received some extraordinary letters from many readers, many of whom said that it heartened them so much that any organization would make that decision because that had not been their experience, the various places they'd worked.
Did you ever hear back from the prisoner himself?
I did, and I was really quite moved. I did not write to him to tell him what I had done because I didn't want to... I know that letters are read, and I didn't want to create any trouble for him after having gone to such great lengths to protect his identity. But he saw the letter, and
he saw the fundraising letter.
He saw the fundraising letter, and he wrote a very moving letter.
Did you bring a copy?
Yes, I do have a copy here. Yeah.
Would you read it?
He said, "I was shocked when I came across your Friend of the Sun letter and read of the difficulties and expense you had to suffer to take my name off my reader's rights submission. I thank you for that. I feel terrible that you had to cancel the entire print run, but I'm grateful, as having my name published would have put me in a very bad situation and possibly triggered some undesired attention. You visualized me perfectly, Mr. Safransky, flipping through the sun with my breath held, then breathing a sigh of relief when I saw my piece signed, name withheld. I hadn't the slightest clue what you'd gone through to make that happen. I understand how you must have struggled with the decision, and I'm sure you'll get a lot of flack for doing what you did. Your words and kindness brought tears to my eyes. I've asked my mom to donate some money to you to make up in some small way for the financial loss you had to take. I'm also sending a little bit from my trust account. It's not much, but it's a lot for me. Thank you for allowing prisoners to share our experiences with the outside world, which I will never get to be a part of again, except through the written word. And thank you for caring about me. If not for your actions, I would have faced some cold-blooded murderer trying to make his bones. I will never forget what you've done."
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. I asked Cy Safransky what it meant to him to get that letter from the prisoner.
I felt gratified. I felt moved. I must say that through this process, and partly because I had read about his crimes, I didn't really want to make this so much about him in one sense, that there was a principle that I wanted to uphold. But because I also knew from his original cover letter, I believe, when he first submitted, that he had committed his crimes when he was, he said, in a psychotic state brought on by drugs and alcohol, and that he really did seem to be trying to create a more compassionate, thoughtful life for himself in prison. I couldn't help but feel this odd personal connection with this man I'd never met. And certainly hearing that, had we made an interpretation of negative flack as being someone merely calling him a name, when in fact it might have been someone murdering him, I felt, well, that our decision was validated in some way. And the fact that he's on death row really, in a way, seemed irrelevant, since we're all on death row, you might say. So having, you know, not only having upheld a sense of journalistic ethics, but also having been merciful and receiving this response, seemed to close the circle, and it was gratifying.
Did you learn something about yourself going through this experience?
The most interesting thing I learned was that wave of revulsion when I read about his crimes. And for a moment, I felt the way I think a lot of people feel when they don't get beyond wanting to punish those who have done something awful, terrible. There's no question his crimes were terrible. And the wish to punish someone for that. I do think that that tends to inform a lot of our political dialogue.
Well, you were surprised to find it in you.
Yes, I was. I was. And I was also grateful that I was able to be aware that it's, you know, it's a place I can go to within myself. It's certainly not a place I need to identify with. For me, that was an interesting revelation. I do think that whatever time he has left, knowing that he was honored as a person, that his basic humanity was honored, I think is important, you know, an important experience for him to have had. And I wouldn't attempt to quantify that or say what it means, but that gesture itself. Whenever any of us, I think, are treated respectfully, it's important to us.
Cy Safransky is editor and publisher of The Sun magazine. We have a link to the prisoner story and to Cy's magazine on our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.